what the public and what the government might be able to do to address and respond to this question. So let's just start with this slide looking at the proportion of microbes per humans. And what you can see is there are a lot more of them than us. And we're constantly in a sea and an environment of microbes. Of course, most of the time it doesn't hurt us, but I don't even know how to say this number, 5 times 10 to the 31st microbes in the world versus humans. The next slides, of course, shows, again, illustrates that microbes are extremely adaptable, and they live in a lot of places where we don't. They can live without oxygen. They live in boiling water, in ice, in rocks, in the sea where there's never any sun, places that humans could never live. Next is just a potpourri of some of the recent articles about super germs, super bugs, resistant staph, all those things. And I'm sure that you've been aware of a lot of a surge in not only the scientific literature, but also in the lay literature on these kinds of bugs. The next slide just shows the secular trends of the approximate prevalence of penicillinase-producing methicillin-susceptible strains of Staph aureus in hospitals a few decades ago. And, of course, you know, when penicillin was first discovered and then used in general, essentially all Staph aureus isolates, 99.99%, were susceptible to penicillin. But it didn't take long at all before penicillinase-producing strains took over. And so by the 1970s, in hospitals, essentially 100% of of Staph aureus were resistant to penicillin. At that time, then, of course, methicillin came into being. But the reason I show this is because we need to have good institutional and historical memory and remember the fact that essentially the challenge is to keep up with the bugs. Every time a new antimicrobial agent is discovered or developed, there will be organisms that will emerge and become increasingly resistant. It's just the nature of the beast. The next slide shows that from 1980s through 2000, the rise in the rates of MRSA, of VRE, and of fluoroquinolone-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, again, the point being that no matter what organism we look at, there's increasing resistance over the past few decades as antibiotics are used and then strains emerge that are resistant to those antibiotics. Next slide shows the same thing. This is from the NIST data from CDC. You can see rates of methicillin MRSA and vancomycin-resistant enterococci. Many of you have seen this slide in non-intensive care units and intensive care units from the decade of the 90s up to 2000. So essentially, everything we look at, we see the same strain. The next one is MRSA-related hospitalization rates from 1999 through 2005. And again, MRSA hospitalization rates are increasing. And this is rates per 1,000 hospitalizations. So in 2005, 8 per 1,000 hospitalizations related to MRSA. Next slide just shows again the increase in third-generation cephalosporin-resistant Klebsiella and fluoroquinolone-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Next slide shows new beta-lactamases reported each year. And beta-lactamase strains are responsible for resistance to penicillin, cephalosporins, and carbapenems. And again, you can see the increase in the last decade or so. Next is trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole resistance in bacterial patient isolates. This is from a study from one hospital, and again, the same kind of increase both in HIV units and in non-HIV units. And the next slide from Australia, because this is a global problem, showing the increase in notifications of MRSA in Western Australia, the either the community acquired strains and the hospital related strains as well. And next slide just gives you numbers about the percent increase among fluoroquinolone resistant Pseudomonas, third generation cephalosporins, etc. The bottom line is that we continue to see every 5 years 20-40% or 20-50% increases in resistance rates in hospital strains. This is in ICUs. This, unfortunately, on the next slide, is this problem of emerging and increasing resistance is occurring simultaneously with a reduction in the numbers of new antibacterial agents being developed by pharmaceutical companies. So you see in this sign by in this graph by Spellberg that in the years 2003-06, there were only 6 new antibacterial agents under development and approved in the U.S., whereas in previous years, there were much higher rates of new antibacterials being developed. The reasons for this are probably multifactorial, certainly economic. There's less incentive for pharmaceutical companies to develop new antibacterial agents because the patents do not last as long as they used to, so that they have to get their profit in more quickly than they used to. And, you know, I'm sure there are other political reasons and other reasons as well. The next slide just summarizes the fact that drug-resistant pathogens are a growing threat. Each year, about 2 million patients get an infection in the hospitals, as you know. More than 70% of the bacteria now causing hospital-associated infections in the U.S. are resistant to one or more drugs that were in the past used to treat them. These rates are lower if we have any participants in this from the Scandinavian countries, from the Netherlands, and so forth. The activities that have been done in Denmark and the Netherlands and other countries to keep the rates of resistance low in hospitals are very credible, but we have not been successful in the UK and in the US and in Australia and other countries at keeping these rates lower. And of course, as you know, persons who are infected with drug-resistant organisms are actually more likely to have significantly longer hospital stays and require treatment with less effective, more toxic, and/or more expensive drugs. So it's the problem of healthcare-associated infections is actually multiplied by the fact that most of them now are caused by multiply drug-resistant organisms. As you probably already know, the new CDC guideline for isolation precautions and also the part of the guideline specifically related to MDROs have just been published in the last few months. They're available on the CDC website. They're also published as a supplement in the December issue of the American Journal of Infection Control, but you can get them through free on the website as well. Now, the next few slides, I just want to talk a little bit about resistance in the community and the interaction between resistance passing between the community and healthcare facilities. So, again, as you know, about a fourth of us are carriers, healthy colonized carriers of Staph aureus, usually in the anterior nares. And generally, this is part of the normal flora. It's not a problem. But in the past 5 years, there's been increasing cases and some outbreaks and deaths among healthy persons with a new community strain of antibiotic-resistant Staph aureus. Now, this strain differs from the hospital strains in a number of ways. For example, it's less likely to be resistant to other antibiotics besides methicillin, and it is more likely to have Pantone-Valentine leukocidin toxin, and they are more likely to be of a certain kind of clone or strain. But this new community strain seems to potentially be more virulent, although we're not really sure, because it looks like the prevalence is not very high, but perhaps increasing. So in the next few slides, I just wanted to put a bit of a human face on the community-acquired MRSA episodes that we're seeing. The first one is Carlos Don in January of last year. He was 12 years old. He came back, healthy young man. He came back from a school trip. He had what he thought was the flu. He was started on antibiotics, hospitalized on a ventilator, and died within a few days of community-acquired MRSA. Now, I don't think anybody knows exactly where he got it, but it is more common to see this kind of an infection among members of athletic teams and groups that have close contact with each other. The next slide shows a picture of Simon. He's age 14 months. His mother has a doctorate in public health, and he died within 24 hours of MRSA sepsis. Again, perfectly healthy, community-associated strain, and unclear where he got it. Next is Brandon. Brandon was is a Washington Redskins defensive tackle. He had knee surgery, developed an MRSA infection, and I'm not sure if this one was hospital-acquired or community-associated, but he has said that this infection has had a huge impact on his life and on his family, and this is just another, he's in one of the high-risk groups for the community-acquired infections. And then Bryce, a healthy 14-month-old who contracted MRSA and spent weeks in the ICU, he actually did survive. He's at home, but his medical bills to date are over $1 million. The next slide is just one typical day. I looked at one day in the media in November to see how many, and this I did just in, you know, less than a half an hour, how many articles there were across the country related to MRSA. And you can see that it's become a big topic of conversation for the media. These are just some pictures of MRSA. Often it's a skin and soft tissue infection, such as on the top two. All of these are skin and soft tissue infections. Sometimes it's pustules, and I'm sure you've heard about the classic issue in the prisons where the prisoners thought that they had spider bites when in fact it was MRSA. And right now we have an MRSA epidemic, an outbreak going on in one of the prison systems in the west coast of the U.S. The next slide just shows other kinds of manifestations of MRSA. Now, the next slide just summarizes or depicts the epidemiology of transmission of resistant bacteria between tertiary hospitals on the left side. Nursing homes and extended care facilities, as you know, are a very important, one of the most important reservoirs for resistance of any kinds of bacteria, not just MRSA, but other kinds as well, one of the biggest reservoirs. Community hospitals, and then, of course, daycare centers and some international influx. Daycare centers and military camps are, again, big sources of resistance because of the close proximity to each other and because, for example, in child care centers, there's not always the best hygiene, and little children are exchanging their flora and their secretions all the time. Of course, we have to mention antibiotics in agriculture as one of the issues related to emerging rates of resistance. Antimicrobials are, in the U.S., still routinely added to animal feed and water to promote animal growth. The rationale is that it promotes more rapid growth, reduces farming expenses, and I am working with a colleague right now to actually review the literature for evidence that there's a causal link between the use of antibiotics in agriculture and resistance in humans. There isn't that much research, but there is some that was done in the early 1970s by Stuart Levy showing that if you if you randomize chickens and segregate them into those that receive antibiotics and those that don't, within a few weeks, the colony that has received antibiotics has highly antibiotic-resistant flora, as do the handlers, the farm handlers who handle those chickens, whereas it's not the case in the ones who didn't receive antibiotics. The next slide shows the percentage of U.S. swine as of 2 years ago that were still receiving antibiotics in their feed, and you can see that among nursery pigs, it was close to 90%. Among grower pigs, a little bit under 80%. Now, this is not the case in Europe and other places, but it is still in the U.S. Now, I just want to go through the chronology of the development of resistance. In the 1940s and 50s, in 1940, Dr. Flory discovered the killing properties of penicillin, and it was first widely used as an antibiotic during World War II for the soldiers. It was in 1943 that drug companies first started to mass produce penicillin, and in 1958, the Nobel Prize was given for the discovery of bacteria's ability to exchange genetic material by plasmids, and part of that genetic material that is exchanged is, in fact, resistance. In the 1960s, there was fast developing resistance, but a large number of new antibiotics entered the market. And at that time, I think this was the golden era of antibiotics. We sort of thought that any new microorganism that might emerge, we would have an antibiotic to take care of it. And methicillin was introduced in 60, and within a year, MRSA was turning up in hospitals around the world. In 1967, penicillin-resistant streptococcal pneumonia was discovered in New Guinea. In the 1970s and 80s, antibiotics were routinely prescribed for viral infections as outpatients, and there was strong antibiotics, more and more antibiotics used for immune deficiency and immune deficient patients such as transplants and cancer. In 1977, strep pneumonia bacterium was found for the first time to be resistant to every available drug. Every one that was available at the time in South Africa. And in 83, 18 people were hospitalized for antibiotic-resistant salmonella from beef that was fed antibiotics. In 86, almost two decades ago, Sweden banned antibiotics from animal food. In the 1990s, drug firms reduced their research and development funds for discovery of new antimicrobial agents. In 1992, antibiotic-resistant infections killed about 13,000 hospital patients. In 1998, Denmark taxed antibiotics used as animal growth promoters. The EU banned use of human antibiotics for animal feed. And in 1999, the U.S. launched an interagency task force on antimicrobial resistance, but we still do not have strong laws banning the use of human antibiotics for animal feeds. In the decade of the 2000s in the U.S., there was a congressional act to take strong steps to reduce resistance, but it was not funded. And then, of course, the anthrax scare, which resulted in people stockpiling ciprofloxacin. And in 2003, there was a large outbreak of multiply drug-resistant Acinetobacter in Iraqi war soldiers, leading to many amputations. The next slide just shows inappropriate use. You see the ad, which was not really at Disneyland, saying free Cipro with admission. Again, still in this decade, in 2005, France banned 12 sore throat medications which contained antibiotics. The EU banned using any antibiotic to promote animal growth, but the U.S. still has made minimal similar efforts. And in 2007, of course, these things you're familiar with from the lay press. There were cases of multiply drug-resistant TB that quadrupled the rate in South Africa. WHO launched a plan to fight MDR-TB. The avian flu virus is evolving, of course, to be resistant to current vaccine strains. There are 10 times as many cases in MRSA in hospitals than previously thought. That research was just published by Bill Jarvis in AJIC as well in the I think it's the December issue. Okay, so let's just talk for a minute about MDR-TB. It kills about 2 million people worldwide every year. The rate has doubled in the past few years in many countries. And of course, you all remember the big issue last summer when Andrew Speaker went on his honeymoon with extremely multi-drug resistant TB. We still, I don't think, know exactly where he got it. And he was healthy and has had no problems, but only 30 to 50% of those with extensively resistant strains actually do recover. So let's look at the evolution of drug resistance in Staph aureus. Just to review, this is a CDC slide, and you see the penicillin resistance, then methicillin resistance, now vancomycin resistance has emerged, and we now have vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus as well. The attributable costs of resistance, for example, MRSA versus methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, in some recent studies, the median hospital stay with MRSA was increased by 2 days. The median hospital charges were increased by just under $7,000. In terms of surgical site infection, with a resistant Staph aureus, the median hospital stay increased by 5 days, and the charges increased by $13,000. Now, I just wanted to go over with you some prevalence survey that we recently conducted in prisons in New York State, two prisons. This is published in, I believe, in November in Clinical Infectious Diseases. The first author is Frank Lowy. You can see on this first slide, Sing Sing is a maximum security men's prison, and Bedford Hills is a maximum security women's prison. You can see the demographics of the populations in those prisons. And on the next slide, we did a prevalence survey for a few months in 2006. We found that about 25% had, these are nasal cultures, were Staph aureus positive, which is the same as in the regular, the rest of the community. But 10.5% of those Staph aureus strains were actually MRSA, which is about 10 times higher than the normal population. So the PVL, the pantan-valentine leucocidin that I mentioned, was present in 61% of the MRSA, but it was also present in about a fifth of the methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus in the prisoners. So in the next, now I want to, that's just in the prisons, the bottom line being that where you have groups congregated together, again, such as prisons, military camps, and childcare settings, you do run the risk of having higher rates of resistance. We're now working on the possibility of doing some kind of an intervention study in the prisons to see if we can reduce these rates of transmission of MRSA, because about in the U.S., about 200,000 people are released from the prison system into the community every year. So they do represent a potential important reservoir for resistance, specifically MRSA. The next slide is Staph aureus reports from a lab in Manhattan in 2005. This is from a prevalence survey that was done in Manhattan. Now, this is actual infections and skin and soft tissue infections. And what you can see here is that 35% of the skin and soft tissue infections in patients' samples from Lab A were actually MRSA. The rest were methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus. Now I'm going to go through a series of slides to talk about the demographic characteristics of this population who had community-associated MRSA in Manhattan. What you see on the left of the slide, the first one is the age range of people, is the age ranges of the patients with community-associated MRSA. Compared on the right side with the age ranges of the New York City population. So what you see in the age slide is that the patients with MRSA were actually significantly more likely, these are all statistically significant differences, to be in the age range of 14 to 24, that is young adults. The next slide looks at gender, at sex. So 65% of the community-associated MRSA were males, whereas in the New York City population, 47% are male. So these people were significantly more likely to be male. The next slide looks at race and ethnicity. And what you can see is that the majority of patients with community-associated MRSA were non-Hispanic white, Caucasian, as compared with the New York City population. And the next one shows household education. So the community-associated MRSA people were actually significantly higher levels of education. They were more likely to have gone to college or graduate school. And then risk factors, the next slide, the blue bar is men who have sex with men. The red bar is HIV/AIDS. And what you see on the left is community-associated men who have sex with men, 70% of the MRSA was among men who had sex with men, whereas the New York City population is about 10%. Similarly, 20% of the community-acquired MRSA infections were among people with HIV/AIDS, compared to a much lower prevalence in the entire New York City population. So in summary, community-associated MRSA cases differed significantly from the New York City population in that they were predominantly male, white, non-Hispanic, higher proportion of 24 to 64-year-olds, more affluent, highly educated, and concentrated in Manhattan. Now, I want to actually tell you something after I've gone through all that data, because I think it's important to, as epidemiologists and infection control people, to always ask if there's any sampling bias. I remember I told you that this was in Lab A, and so it was from a certain lab that received their specimens from a certain part of Manhattan. And this part of Manhattan actually was in Chelsea and in other areas where there is a higher preponderance of gay and lesbians and younger people. So this could be in part a sampling bias because these data are not necessarily the same as others. So always be thinking about that. And I actually like to show this because the Department of Health and Hygiene for New York City is actually doing this study. And the epidemiologist who loaned me these slides or gave me permission to use these slides actually notes also that they're trying to now sort out whether this is a sampling bias or whether, in fact, people with community-associated MRSA in New York City do have different risk factors than the regular population. Now the next is just a quote that says, at the beginning of the 21st century, resistance is common. It's developed against every class of antimicrobial drug, and it appears to be spreading into new niches. This is the proportion of resistance to three or more antimicrobial agents among isolates of E. coli in Nigeria. And I show this slide just to show that this is a global problem. It's occurring all over the world. And again, the next one just shows the international spread of resistant clones of pneumococcus. It used to be in previous decades that if someone had pneumococcal pneumonia, we knew what to treat them with. We could give them penicillin and they'd be cured. And that doesn't happen anymore. The next one is resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. And this shows three sets of surveillance data from Massachusetts, from New York City, and from the gonococcal isolate surveillance project. And what you can see is that resistance in Neisseria gonorrhea is more common in men who have sex with men, which is the dark blue bar, less common in heterosexual men, which is the next bar, and in women it's not so common in the two surveillance sites, except in New York City, the prevalence of resistant Neisseria gonorrhea in 2003 was 2%. The next slide shows the Acinetobacter outbreak that occurred in the Iraq soldiers. And this was published in the Emerging Infectious Disease Journal, so it's quite an interesting investigation of the outbreak that they did. But what you can see is that there were 237 active duty soldiers who were admitted to hospitals with injury in this population. 151 had been deployed to Operation Freedom, Iraq anyway. 84 of the soldiers had cultures that were taken. 48 of them had cultures positive for Acinetobacter. So over half of the infections were with this Acinetobacter species. 30 of them represented clinical infection, 18 represented colonization with this resistant one, and 23 of them met the definition of osteomyelitis or wound infection. The next slide actually shows that from this study that there were 16 unique resistance genes and 4 mobile genetic elements detected in 75 unique patient isolates of this organism. Now that's pretty astounding to think that this is such a potpourri of resistance genes, and I guess it's not surprising among the soldiers in Iraq who are intermingling with each other and with others from around the world. 89% of these were resistant to at least 3 classes of antibiotics, and 15% were resistant to every antibiotic tested. 8 major clonal types, very complex genetic background. This next slide just shows the PubMed citations for antibiotic-resistant Acinetobacter in the last couple of decades, and you can see that, again, the resistant Acinetobacter is also increasing. In the old days, we used to think of Acinetobacter pretty much as normal flora and not really a big problem. But we're now seeing resistant Acinetobacter emerge as a healthcare-associated infection as well, and I imagine that some of you have seen it in your facilities. Next just shows a global spread of a distinct single genetic hospital strain of VRE that made it around the world in a very short time. Of course, the mechanisms of resistance, one is emergence, which occurs because of microbial evolution, and the other is dissemination of resistant organisms, either at the microbial level by spread from plasmids, but importantly for infection control folks, at the population level because of the transmission dynamics that go on in the hospital or in the community. There are a few characteristics in certain organisms that enhance their ability to be resistant. One is that, well, all bacteria double about every 20 to 30 minutes. So if there's one mutant, then it can increase very quickly. The other is exchangeability because of plasmids and transposons and other things where bacteria can exchange genetic material. And then, of course, mutation under antibiotic pressure where you kill off the common strains. And some species are intrinsically more resistant because of things such as spore-forming ability, such as Clostridium difficile or Clostridium botulinum, and capsule formation, such as occurs with Klebsiella. And the capsule sometimes protects the microorganism from being affected by the antibiotic. So the 3 fundamental mechanisms for resistance are enzymatic degradation of drugs, alterations of the bacterial proteins that are the targets for the antibiotics, or changes in permeability of the membrane to the antibiotics. The next slide just shows a picture of the transfer of resistance, either by mutation, where there's no transfer, it's just mutation. Transformation is where free DNA is transformed. Transduction occurs when a phage, a virus, actually infects a bacteria and can give the bacteria a transposable element, which then becomes part of the bacterial chromosome and allows the bacteria to be resistant. And then conjugation, which is sometimes called bacterial sex. We'll show a picture of it, a classic picture, in a minute. Next slide is just an illustration of how natural selection works. First, variation, inheritance, selection, time, and adaptation are the stages. So here are some black crows, and they love green beetles. They're their favorites. So they just eat the green beetles, and they leave the orange beetles alone. Generations later, there's more orange beetles because the black crows are eating all of the green beetles. That's sort of selection. And over time, the green beetles will be eaten up, and they have been selected against, and the brown beetles have flourished. So this is sort of an analogy for resistance. This next slide just shows the classic picture of two microorganisms with a bridge that is transmitting by a plasmid various genetic traits, one of which can be resistance, between two organisms. The one on the right, I believe, is an E. coli, and the one on the left, I think, is a Proteus. So they can actually transfer genetic resistance mechanisms across species, which is another reason why antibiotic resistance can spread very quickly. So now let's talk about what the public, what healthcare institutions, and what governments can do to avoid resistance. For the public, obviously, we need to talk about careful hygiene, particularly in moist, busy environments such as gyms, not sharing things, avoiding antibacterial soaps with triclosan. Now, this has not been shown to cause resistance in humans. It's just a theoretical concern at this point. Not demanding antibiotics for viral infections and URIs, not saving them, taking antibiotics, sharing them with a family, etc. I just wanted to give you some data from some recent surveys that we've done. We just surveyed 453 households in our neighborhood here, which represents over 2,000 people. These respondents were primarily Hispanics, and 50% of them were born outside the U.S., so these are in general new immigrants, but 88% of them thought that colds were caused by bacteria. Only less than a third agreed that most colds or flu could improve without medications. Almost 90% said that antibiotics were usually or sometimes needed to treat a viral infection, and 27% stated that antibiotics were usually or sometimes indicated for asthma. So what you can see here is tremendous educational needs. And in fact, in this population, those who were born in the U.S. who had lived here a long time did not do any better on the knowledge than those who were born outside the U.S. So this is not just among recent immigrants. This is a knowledge deficits that are pretty amazing, that people thought that you can't get over a viral throat infection without antibiotics, et cetera. And we did a survey several years ago in antibiotic prescriptions in New York City. What we did is we looked at three different neighborhoods within Manhattan, and we looked at independent pharmacies, grocery stores, delicatessens, bodegas, which are small, sort of like delicatessens, and health food stores in 30 square blocks of three major commercial areas. The first area was a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. The second area was predominantly black, that's Harlem. And the third area was predominantly Caucasian. What we did is we had a trained surveyor of the same ethnicity as in the neighborhood, and they went into the store and they looked to see if there were any antibiotics available on the shelf or over the counter or on request, because as you know, of course, it's illegal to sell antibiotics without a prescription from a healthcare provider. We surveyed 101 stores. There were no antibiotics available in the black or Caucasian neighborhoods, but in almost a fourth of the stores in the Hispanic neighborhood, antibiotics were available right on the shelf, and they were also available in all the stores, 100% of the stores, upon request. So in this neighborhood, even though it's illegal, a high proportion of the population is buying antibiotics over the counter without a prescription, and they're buying them for a variety of uses, not just for bacterial infections, but also for the flu, and as you saw, even for asthma. They were offered, our people who did the survey, ampicillin, amoxicillin, tetracycline, erythromycin, and they were offered as either single doses individually wrapped for a quarter, so you could buy one pill for a quarter, or in larger quantities, and they would mix and match if you wanted to. So even though it's illegal in this country, people can get acquire antibiotics in stores and certainly on the street. Here's some of the educational materials available through the CDC website and through various state health department websites, both in English and in Spanish, and other countries have them, of course, as well. So these kinds of materials are actually very nice, but it's not clear that they're being used that much. And this is just more of what the public needs to have, is more education. Then the next slide just talks about prescribing patterns among clinicians in the community. These were three surveys that were done. In the first survey, 25 to 56%, I mean in several surveys, of clinicians, physicians, actually reported that they did prescribe antibiotics for viral URIs simply because people expected them. And when they were presented with clinical scenarios of viral pharyngitis, 81% of surveyed clinicians used an inappropriate treatment strategy, and 22% of emergency department visitors reported that their physicians routinely prescribed antibiotics for a cold. So you can see that we still have a long way to go in terms of the appropriate use of antibiotics in the community. The next slide just makes the point that nurse practitioners are not any better than physicians. They are just as likely to prescribe an antibiotic inappropriately, and their educational programs frequently do not provide much education in the way of antibiotic use. Okay, now what can healthcare systems do? Certainly, and controlling antibiotic use, preventing cross-transmission, and identifying and acting on infections rapidly. This next slide shows the first purple bar is oncology staff, the second is dermatology staff members in hospital. The beige bar is patients who had been in the hospital for at least 30 days. And the last bar is controls who didn't have any contact with the environment. And this is the percent of their staphylococcal flora that we published that was resistant to these antibiotics. What I want to show you here is that the oncology personnel had significantly more resistance in their skin flora, this is their hand flora, than even patients who'd been in the hospital for 30 days. So staff members themselves are possible reservoirs for antibiotic resistance in their own skin flora. The current status in hospitals is that about 34 per 1,000 patients have active healthcare-associated MRSA infections, and 12 per 1,000 additional are colonized. That means that about 1.2 million patients are infected with MRSA each year in hospitals. What about antimicrobial use? This was a survey in 130 hospitals. Over half of the patients received one of 50 antibacterial agents, and you can see that it was over a million doses, and 776 patient days out of 1,000 people are getting antibiotics. This is the CDC key prevention strategies. It's fourfold: preventing infection, effective diagnosis and treatment, optimizing the use of antibiotics, and preventing transmission. So the 12 steps on the next slide, how well are they actually implemented? The next slide shows a survey that was done in a small group by a colleague of mine to look at potential barriers of adherence to guidelines. And in this survey, they ask infectious disease and pediatric fellows whether they knew about the CDC 12-step program, whether they were familiar with the 12 steps, whether they agreed with them, whether they felt that they could actually do perform the guidelines, etc. So let's move on to the survey. This was neonatology fellows and faculty. Sorry, it wasn't infectious disease fellows. Attending a conference last year, it was a small sample size, but 59% of these neonatology fellows were not aware of the 12-step campaign, and 15% said they were very aware. Only 20% said that they had ever seen the educational materials. Okay, now I'm going back now to this outbreak of the multi-resistant Acinetobacter infections in the military hospital. And what they did in this study is they looked at three potential sources of the infection. They looked at patient skin, soil, and the healthcare environment. And what they found is, in this small sample, the strain, the antibiotic-resistant strain, was prevalent in the environment, but not very prevalent in the soil or in the skin of the patient. So they actually determined that environmental contamination may play a major role in this particular resistant organism, which is different than what we've been saying for a while. We've been sort of emphasizing the human part, but the environment is clearly important as well. The next slide just shows how often asymptomatic healthcare workers are likely to cause MRSA outbreaks. And the bottom line on this, and you have the reference there so you can look it up, is that of 191 outbreaks that were investigated, 8 outbreaks were found where healthcare workers were infected, 3 outbreaks were found where healthcare workers were the carriers, and 13 of the outbreaks were found to be probably related to healthcare workers as the source of the outbreak. In terms of fighting resistance and proper use of antibiotics, in the next slide, this was a survey done of house staff officers, and as you can see, only about 25% of them said that they had automatic entry of antibiotic information in the charts, that they had access to it. Only about a fourth of them said that they actually had guidelines to use for antibiotic ordering. A little over 40% said that they actually had received education in judicious use of antibiotics. About 50% said that they were aware of trends in resistance in their hospital, and just less than 60% said that they actually followed the guidelines. Now, this was a fairly recent survey, so we still have a way to go with judicious use of antibiotics. So the proven control measures in terms of barrier precautions are gowns, gloves, hand hygiene, maybe admission culturing for MRSA. That's the newest active surveillance discussion that's going on right now. Now, let's just end by talking about what the government can do. First of all, they need to provide enough resources so that we can have some good national surveillance. There are some good surveillance systems in Europe. In the U.S., the NARMS system is running on a shoestring, but it provides at least some national information about resistance rates. The government could probably provide stricter tabs and regulations regarding use of antibiotics, at least in animals, if not in humans. It seems like the private sector has been unwilling to do this on its own for whatever reasons, probably economic. Better support for development of new antibiotics and possibly funding for research such as social marketing campaigns to begin to bridge this gap, this knowledge gap in the public about the use of antibiotics. The Infectious Disease Society of America has developed a series of recommendations. I won't go through them here, but the website is there and you can see what they're recommending that government should do about antibiotic resistance. And there are a couple of new things in the U.S. In October, new legislation was introduced called the Strategies to Address Antimicrobial Resistance, or the STAR Act, which provides critical solutions to prevent and control the spread of resistant organisms. And there have been a number of other attempts at legislation. I don't think that we will get into a philosophic discussion about how much of this should be legislated, because part of that is sort of a value judgment and personal opinion, but there are times when the public sector does need help from the government in knowing what they need to know to do the right thing. The question is, will this work? And in European countries, as I said, where hospitals' stringent policies regarding the control of resistance are in place, the rates of MDROs have dropped precipitously. But right now, there's no mechanism in the U.S. to mandate such policies, and it must be done on an individual or institutional basis. So with that, I will stop, and we have about 5 minutes for questions. Oh, and I did want to, on the last slide, just thank all of my dear colleagues who allowed me to use their slides.
Well, thank you very much, Elaine, for another outstanding teleclass. Thank you for starting our teleclass year off with excellence. Can you tell me something about the Center for Interdisciplinary Research to Reduce Antimicrobial Resistance?
Sure. I mean, that's a center that was funded by the National Institutes of Health to try to support and encourage an interdisciplinary approach to a variety of global problems. And some of the other problems that they're working on are things like obesity and health disparities. Ours happened to be on resistance, and it allowed us to have funding for 2 years from the government to bring together a core group of about 14 different disciplines to try to strategize and brainstorm about how we could get out of our individual silos so that people who work in hospitals talk to the community, and people who are doing research in communities talk to the people who live in the communities, and just sort of bring to bear different kinds of expertise than have been used in the past for this important problem. So we've got in the center right now five projects that are ongoing that have to do with hospital-associated MRSA, and some have to do with a variety of antibiotic-resistant things. One is an economic project, and the, you know, like any of these kinds of things, we have to, you know, write grants and so forth, but we're very committed to this idea. And it's just one of many organizations. There are a lot of other good ones. APUA, that's the Association of, Professionals for the Appropriate Use of Antibiotics. That's a group that Stuart Levy formed in Boston, and there are a number of other groups like that.
It's encouraging that it's being studied anyway. I hope some action comes out of it after all this.
Right, yeah. That's the bottom line.
Hi, this is Mary Ann in Spruce Pine, North Carolina. How can we get in touch with the person who's responsible for the CDC 12-step program in our area?
You know, I don't know who's responsible in your area, but I would guess that if you go onto the CDC website, you might actually want to go through your state health department, because a number of state health departments have been getting funding through the Get Smart program.
Right.
Are you involved with that Get Smart program?
I'm familiar with it, and it's been part of my goals for the last 2 years to get it started in my community.
Yeah. That's terrific. And on the CDC website, and under the Get Smart program, it lists every state health department that has funding from CDC to work on education and so forth for the community. So start there. And if you can't find, if you're not one of the funded places, and I know that the Get Smart program doesn't have much money anymore, but I'm sure there'll be someone there who can direct you to the right person. I'm sorry, I don't know specifically.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Good luck.
Thanks again, Dr. Larson, for your time and your talent. And thanks to all of you in the audience. I wish you a very good day, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.